Thank you, Brother Lou. Sorry for the distraction this morning. We're going to hold just for a minute the slides anyway, and bring you some love and greetings and messages. First of all, from our class in Portland, select a text for your greetings of Psalms 37, verse 23. The steps of a good man are ordered by the Lord, and he delighteth in his way. So the brethren in Portland do send their love, and especially a number of brethren who could not make it, including the Furtajewskis and Sister Doris Borowick and a number of other brethren, all wish to have their love brought to you. Also, from our son Aaron and his family in Columbus, Ohio, and trying to remember the others, was the Kramers, Wes and Tony Kramer, and Sharon will have to give you the rest of the list. But those I know brought their love specially. I wanted to mention something else. This is in a way of an announcement more than anything else. But our class has been publishing some items of present truth over quite a number of years, particularly some old-timers that were very faithful. One of them was Pilgrim Echoes that was last printed in 1987. And that book is now has been printed. It is in binding. This is an unbound copy. The rest should be delivered to us in a couple of weeks. In preparation for this book, which is expanded with some more material from Brother Benjamin Barton that we did not know, has been found. And there's about another 50 pages or so in this book. It's been carefully reviewed and edited and proofread and expanded index. But in preparation for that, we redid the CD. Now, some of you acquired this CD before, called Pilgrim Echoes also, the text. It's a computer text. And we found a number of, well, I'm going to say errors, but anomalies is a nicer word, I guess. And it had been updated and cleared up considerably. If any of you have acquired the disc, please see me and I'll give you an updated one. There's no cost for that updated, but you should have the clean version if you have one of these. But don't put off acquiring the book version. I think you'll really enjoy this when it comes. The other thing that the class has had printed early in the year was Faith Foundations by John and Morton Edgar. And that one also has expanded material. And this one is available on the book table. So these are the two publications that have been our projects for this year. And hope that you will enjoy them. Seems like there was something else, but that's the way of announcements. Otherwise, we depend on our notes. Brethren, we hear a good deal in the Bible about buying or purchasing fields. The first notable instance is that in Genesis 23, of Abraham's buying the field at Hebron for 400 shekels of silver for the cave of Machpelah, where Sarah was buried, and later most of the rest of his family. This purchase was all the more remarkable since God had given all the land to Abraham for an inheritance, everlasting inheritance, and Abraham looked for the resurrection of the dead, when that inheritance would be full. The field and the cave is a holy place unto this day. A little bit further to the north, near Shechem, Jacob bought a parcel of a field for 100 pieces of money, we're not told the exact amount, where he spread his tent in Genesis 33:19-20. He named the place El Eloha Israel. This is the celebrated site of Jacob's well, where in after ages the woman from Samaria talked with Jesus. Under the law of Moses, before Israel entered into possession of the land, God prescribed the terms for both temporal and eternal inheritance in the land in Leviticus 25. The law of the Sabbath of rest under the land is given, and then follows the law of the Jubilee. The land shall not be sold forever, for the land is mine. For ye are strangers and sojourners with me. Leviticus 25:23. These things were a real foreshadowing of good things to come, as evidenced from Leviticus 26, where after the curses of disobedience are given, it is said that the land should enjoy her Sabbaths while Israel should be in captivity. Another striking allegorical buying of the field is found in the book of Ruth, where Boaz redeemed a field in which our brother Elimelech is spoken of in Ruth 4, verse 3. A near kinsman declining the redemption, it was left to Boaz to buy the field, and also Ruth the Moabitess, to raise up the name of the dead upon his inheritance. Then there is that wonderful little parable in Matthew 13:45 of the merchant seeking goodly pearls, bought the whole field, just as our Lord bought the whole earth. Many of the records of the Old Testament purchases occur before the prophet Jeremiah, who we would now like to consider. He was the last of the prophets in the land before it was overthrown by Babylon, and had much to say regarding Israel, much to say regarding Judah and the land. The land was desolated under his watch, and it is restored according to his word, the word of the Lord and Jeremiah the prophet. His life and work overlapped that with Ezekiel and Daniel. It was an ominous and foreboding time in Israel's history, as they saw the decline of their own empire and spirit. It was a time when prophets were heard by the people and rejected by kings. There is probably no prophet with such a diverse life. In the first few verses of Jeremiah, we learn that Jeremiah was born in Anathoth, a small town situated 2 to 3 miles north of Jerusalem, but still in the territory of Benjamin. He belonged to a priestly family, probably not the same one as carried the Ark of the Covenant after the return from Egypt. His father was Hilkiah, a priest of Anathoth. But it is generally thought this is not the same Hilkiah, the high priest, that brought forth the book of the law from the cleansed temple in the days of Josiah, noted in 2 Kings 22. Particularly, Jeremiah's father is called a high priest. He is not called a high priest of Jerusalem, but he is a priest. He was a Levitical priest of Anathoth. So in a sense, Jeremiah came from a line of those who sounded a trumpet in the land, and because of his heritage, had particular access to the throne. Nevertheless, Jeremiah began his ministry. We need to turn some of these little messages off that are popping up in the corner. Jeremiah began his ministry in the days of Josiah, Judah's last good king, and continued during his four successors until Zedekiah. He saw both reform and rebellion, repentance and defiance, Through it all, Jeremiah ceased not to declare the whole counsel of God to his people, whether they would hear or whether they would forbear. He was a very young man when he began his work, verses 4 through 7 of chapter 1. It was just at this time that the plundering Scythian hordes, which troubled Asia for decades in the second half of the 7th century, swept past the western boundary of Palestine on their swift horses to capture rich booty in the ancient civilized land of Egypt. We're getting a little switched over here. Do I need to refresh that with the DARS? Okay. Since he continued to prophesy until the conquest and destruction of Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar, Jeremiah's prophetic career covered a period of more than 40 years. All the important events of this period are reflected in his prophecies. The religious reforms instituted by Josiah, the first deportation to Babylon under Jehoiakim, or otherwise named Jeconiah, and the final catastrophe of the Jewish kingdom. The opposition in which Jeremiah seems to have withstood to the priesthood of the sanctuary at Jerusalem was continued in his opposition, which had existed from former times between the priesthood and his former family. There was also the matters of a corrupt priesthood and the throne. We read in Jeremiah 1, 16 and 17 that Jeremiah confronted the compromisers. It is Jeremiah who defiantly predicted that Jerusalem would become a desolate heap and den of dragons, a message not welcomed by the throne. Yet while Jerusalem would become desolate and a place of hissing and a curse, this would last 70 years, after which Israel could return and inhabit the city again. For this reason, Jeremiah counseled the people to not resist the judgments of the Lord and to settle patiently in Babylon, to build houses there, and even to plant gardens and to raise up another generation that would eventually return. Jeremiah denounced Judah's compromising priesthood, as we've said, the evil kings and the waywardness of the people. When King Jehoiakim heard the prophecies of this book, read by the court reader named Jehudi, he cast the scroll into the palace fireplace, sheet by sheet, as it was read to him. It had taken over a year to write the manuscript and destroyed in an hour. But not deterred, Jeremiah rewrote the book with the help of his faithful secretary, Baruch. It is not surprising that to silence him, he was detained in bonds, imprisoned in dungeons, let down into a miry pit of slime, yet not destroyed for fear of the people, who still heard his message, and partly because the leaders somewhat feared that his prophetic visions may be indeed true. With all the austere hardships in Jeremiah's life, the Lord gave him another directive in Jeremiah 16, verses 2 through 4. Thou shalt not take thee a wife, neither shalt thou have sons or daughters in this place. For thus saith the Lord concerning the sons and concerning the daughters that are born in this place, and concerning their mothers that bear them, and concerning their fathers that begat them in this land, they shall die of grievous deaths. So Jeremiah never married. He had no children. At least he was spared the loss and agony that the inhabitants of Jerusalem were soon to face. After Babylon had destroyed Jerusalem and deported the population, Jeremiah was one of the very few that was left behind with the governor appointed Gedaliah to harvest some of the vineyards and fields at Mizpah that last year in the land. Jeremiah 40, 4 through 6, and verse 10. Then that little community rebelled in a few months. They slew Gedaliah, and then, fearing retribution from the Chaldeans, the survivors fled to Egypt, and they took Jeremiah with them. Jeremiah chapter 41. And there he continued to declare the words of the Lord until he died in Egypt. Brethren, yet amid this background, Jeremiah was not altogether a messenger of woe. He was commissioned in chapter 1, verse 10, not only to pull down and to destroy, but also to build and to plant. In Jeremiah 30, 10 and 11, prophesies a return from the land of their captivity and from all nations where they were scattered, to be in rest and be in quiet, and none shall make them afraid. And you are well familiar with the 31st chapter, 31 to 34, gives the details of the new covenant with Israel and Judah, wherein all shall know the Lord from the least unto the greatest. While Israel may have thought this to be the work accomplished under the delivering hand of Cyrus, yet in its fullest sense, it is the messianic promise for many generations ahead of their times at the hand of a greater than Cyrus. Against this background, brethren, we want to examine some details of chapter 32. Jeremiah 32. It begins in the 10th year of Zedekiah and the 18th year of Nebuchadnezzar. That was just 1 year before Jerusalem fell, because it was the 11th year of Zedekiah and the 19th year of Nebuchadnezzar that the city was burned. Jeremiah was detained in the palace prison, but probably not under chains or high security, for he could have visitors there, but he was kept off the streets from further inciting the people. And while in prison, he has a word of the Lord come to him in verses 6 and 7. We read, "The word of the Lord came unto me, saying, Buy thee my field, that is in Anathoth, for the right of redemption is thine." This came concerning his cousin Hanamiel, the son of Shulam, his uncle. So Hanamiel was his first cousin, and as such had the right of redemption under the Mosaic law. If Hanamiel needed some quick cash in these desperate hours that under the siege of Babylon, as Babylon had already invaded the land, then according to the Mosaic law, Jeremiah had the right to purchase it from his cousin. Now, the Levites had orchards or fields beyond city walls, according to Numbers 35, 2 and 3. And these suburbs were community grazing fields for flocks and sheep, and therefore a perpetual inheritance that no one person could ever sell to another. Leviticus 25, verse 34. But there was a different rule for Levitical property that was inside the city. This must have been some meadow or orchard or garden personally held within the city, of which the Levites could hold an exchange among themselves only, and certainly not to any foreigner or stranger. Leviticus 25, 32 to 33. According to Leviticus 25, verse 25, the next of kin could buy this property inside the city, of a Levitical city only, keeping it in the hands of the Levitical family only. It is interesting that such a bill of sale would document not only the Levitical owner, but the whole city as belonging to the perpetual Levitical appointment of Joshua 21, 18 and 19, where such cities were appointed specifically to the Levites when Joshua divided the land. In any case, the Lord instructed Jeremiah to make the purchase if and when Hanameel should come to him. So Jeremiah did not send for him or request that he make the transaction, but he simply waited. And in due course, verse 8, Hanameel arrived and asked Jeremiah to make the purchase. It was a fulfillment of the prediction that God made to him. But why would he cumber himself with this purchase while detained in bonds? One could possibly say he simply was obeying the voice of the Lord, and that is true. Or perhaps he wanted to assist his financially stressed cousin. But brethren, one would not have expected that a prophet should concern himself so far in the business of this world. And besides, who wants to buy fields in the neighborhood of a besieged city? One would not have expected that one who had neither wife nor children should buy land. We find in Jeremiah 16, verse 2, that he had no family of his own. He had none to leave the property to of his relationship when he might die. So for what purpose was he to purchase it? He could make no use of it while sitting in Zedekiah's prison. It was most strange that he should buy a piece of land when he himself knew that the whole land was now to be laid waste and fall into the hands of the Chaldeans. And then what good would it do to him? But most importantly, the Lord knew very well that Israel had kept the last typical Jubilee and that there would not be another. There would be no more counting of the 50 years to the return of the land to the families. But it was the will of God that he should buy it. And he complied, though the money would seem to have been a lost cause. So Jeremiah obeyed the voice of the Lord against every practical objection. But brethren, the eyes of a prophet see not as man sees. Jeremiah saw this as an affirmation that God would bring back his people whom he foreknew to this land of promise. For this reason, Jeremiah performed a very exacting public transaction. As so often it was with Jeremiah, he acted out the prophecy. And so now, in chapter 32, verse 9, he was able to carry out the transaction while in prison. How was it so? The key may seem to have been with Baruch, later mentioned in verses 12 and 13. This was Jeremiah's secretary, or amanuensis. But he may have been more. He may have been Jeremiah's banker, his notary, his power of attorney. And so the money is brought into the prison courtyard, weighed out first before Hanamiel, and the price is paid as 17 shekels of silver. This is rather a small amount for a piece of land. Even in today's money, it would be between $10 and $20. And some might reason that Jeremiah diminished the value of the field based either on the years near to the Jubilee or due to the fact that the city was under siege. But brethren, we would not so minimize Jeremiah's integrity in fairly dealing with his cousin, nor shortchanging him under the rite of redemption. The form of the expression here in the ninth verse is very unique and notable in the Hebrew language. It is not the word 17. It is reads literally in Hebrew, 7 shekels and 10 pieces of silver. And so reads Leiser translation and many other critical renderings. 7 shekels. Some Hebrew scholars have read this to mean 7 shekels of gold and the 10 of silver, making this sale notably larger than would be understand by that we would understand by 17 shekels of silver only, and perhaps it was several hundred dollars. But now he agreed, and he showed the evidence of the money with his cousin. This was a remarkable transaction, where we might think a handshake and exchange of a money pouch would be sufficient between family members. The first thing we notice is that the money seems to have been weighed even twice, a second time, the second time before witnesses. In the ninth verse, it is weighed, and is weighed again in the tenth verse. At this time in Israel, money was not stamped or marked with individual coin values, but the rare metal ingots were weighed for the total agreed upon value. Furthermore, here came witnesses, more than Baruch, in the employ of Jeremiah. Here were legal notaries who came to the courtyard of the prison to validate this transaction. In such legal transactions, there were 2 indentures, of which one was the purchase deed and was signed by the purchaser and the witnesses. It was then sealed and handed over to the buyer. And then there was an open deed as an exact copy and was intended for common use in case its authenticity was called into question. The sealed copy could be opened and produced before the judge. The seal opened, and if its contents agreed with those of the open deed in the city courts, the decision would be in favor of the buyer. We have here all the circumstances of this legal act, and they are, as we said, quite remarkable. First, an offer is made for purchase that seems to be based upon the Jubilee, at least the Mosaic law of the right of purchase of a near kinsman. Yet there was to be no further Jubilee in the antitype, until the antitype, the type having just been completed. Second, the price is agreed on and the payment is weighed in the balances. A contract or deed of sale is drawn up to which both parties agreed. Witnesses are brought forward to see it signed and sealed, for the contract was both subscribed and sealed. And then a duplicate of the deed was drawn, which was not to be sealed, but usually to lie open for public inspection in some public place where it might be safe and reviewed. The original was sealed up, was put in an earthen pitcher in order to be preserved from accidents. And this was delivered by the purchaser into the hands of Baruch to be preserved for the use of Jeremiah, and witnesses were called to attest the delivery. They subscribed the book of the purchase, perhaps like a town ledger or registry where such purchases were entered. Baruch was a scribe by profession, and the deeds were delivered into his hands before witnesses to be preserved, it says, for a long time. Perhaps the law in this case required that the instrument should be thus lodged in Jeremiah's or Baruch's home of residence. But in the present case, both deeds, the original and the duplicate, were put into earthen pitchers because the city was about to be destroyed in the general conflagration of flames. Now, in the 13th and 14th verses, we see here the charge to Baruch. This means that the sealed and the open ones were preserved in clay jars. The earthen or clay vessels were more durable and decay resistant than a wooden box or even a metal container that could be subject to corrosion and to water. The sealed vessel was secured to continue many days. This suggests it was buried in the earth or in a rainproof cave. Though it is not said, this earthen vessel with these deeds in it were to be put underground or in a small cave, and very probably in some part of the field that was purchased. Had these writings been laid up in a chest or box, they might have been stolen and destroyed. And had they been laid in the earth by themselves, they would have rotted and consumed. But by being put into a dry earthen vessel, they might be preserved from injury from the air and moisture of the earth, and so might continue many days, even many years. Brethren, we have seen how such documents survived in Qumran for centuries and millennia in unsealed clay vessels. This really had nothing to do with some days until Jeremiah's possible release. This was to be for a long time. Firstly, he didn't even expect amnesty at the hands of Zechariah. He knew the city was doomed by the advancing armies of Nebuchadnezzar. Supposedly, families would return after 70 years in Babylon and retrieve the documents and reestablish the priestly family functions in Anathoth. This would seem to be the prospect mentioned here in the 15th verse. But this was not to be so. There arises another anomaly or oddity. the title deed had been transferred from the family of Hanamel to a single cousin that's unmarried with no family. And then with a twist of providence, Jeremiah was not even taken to Babylon to perhaps, if he was, he might negotiate a later transfer to surviving members there in Babylon. But he was alone in Egypt. Furthermore, Jeremiah had no family, as we have mentioned, of his own to perpetuate an inheritance of any kind to receive the deed. It was rightfully his by divine decree, but he died before he could ever return and take possession. More importantly, there is no further biblical record of these documents ever being retrieved or used for restoring the inheritance. So why did God ask him to do it? It would seem to have been lost or forgotten to history, and a lost cause for Jeremiah's deliberations. Was God's appointment a lost cause? Now, having delivered the documents to the faithful hands of his secretary and his aide, Baruch, Jeremiah's prayer is recorded in verses 16 through 26. We'd like to read just a few excerpts here from Jeremiah 32, beginning with verse 16. Now, when I had delivered the evidence of the purchase unto Baruch, the son of Neriah, I prayed unto the Lord, saying, Ah, Lord God, behold, thou hast made the heavens and the earth by thy great power and stretched out arm, and there is nothing too hard for thee. And then verse 23, And they came in and possessed it, but they obeyed not the voice, neither walked in thy law. They have done nothing of all that thou commandest them to do. Therefore thou hast caused all this evil to come upon them. The siege of Nebuchadnezzar. And then verse 25. And thou hast said unto me, O Lord God, buy thee the field for money, and take witnesses, for the city is given into the hands of the Chaldeans. The Lord answers him in verse 27. Is there anything too hard for me? And then proceeds a recording of the just judgments upon Israel and Judah. Verse 27. Is there anything too hard for me? But beginning with verse 28, and onward begins a remarkable promise of ultimate return and restoration that reaches far beyond the return under Cyrus and reaches to the very blessings of the millennial kingdom. And we would like to read verses 37 to 44. Behold, I will gather them out of all countries whither I've driven them in mine anger, and in my fury, and in my great wrath, and I will bring them again into this place, and I will cause them to dwell safely, and they shall be my people, and I will be their God. And I will give them one heart and one way, and that they may fear me forever, for the good of them and their children after them. And I will make an everlasting covenant with them, that I will not turn away from them to do them good, but I will put my fear in their hearts, that they may not depart from me, Yea, I will rejoice over them to do them good, and will plant them in this land assuredly, and with my whole heart and with my whole soul. For thus says the Lord, like as I have brought all this great evil upon this people, so I will bring upon them all the good that I have promised them. And fields shall be bought in this land, whereof they say, it is desolate without man or beast. It is given into the hand of the Chaldeans. Men shall buy fields for money, and subscribe evidence, and seal them, and take witnesses in this land of Benjamin, and in the places round about Jerusalem, and the cities of Judah, and in the cities of the mountains, and in the cities of the valley, and in the cities of the south. For I will cause their captivity to return, saith the Lord. Notice the divine footnote here that men shall buy fields for money and subscribe evidence and seal them and take witnesses in the land of Benjamin and in the places of Jerusalem. This is directly built upon the act prescribed by God for Jeremiah, of which he could see no fulfillment in his lifetime, nor any descendant could claim even in the 70 years afterwards. We are reminded of Deacon Stephen's discourse about Abraham in Acts 7, verse 5. And he gave him none inheritance into it, not so much as to set his foot on, yet he promised that he would give it to him for a possession and to his seed after him, when as yet he had no child. And Paul's statement in Hebrews 11, verse 13. These all died in faith, not having received the promise, but having seen them afar off, and were persuaded of them, and embraced them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims in the earth. And it was the same with Jeremiah. So here, only when Jeremiah is resurrected among the ancient prophets will the power of this symbolic act be realized. Or, brethren, is there something more than symbolism in this act? Let us look at the ancient city of Anathoth. Is now called Anata, A-N-A-T-A, still having fields and sheep round about. But now notice something very peculiar about the city where the field is located. You will notice on a map of Israel that there is what is called the Green Line, just beyond the northeast edge of Jerusalem. Here is the old city, Mount Scopus, and the city of Anata, divided by what is called the Green Line. Beyond this city, beyond this line, the faithful citizens of Israel called this land Judea and Samaria, and what politicians today call the West Bank. Anathoth, now called Anata, lies just east of this line. Here is Jerusalem, and here is Anata. In this aerial view, which you may not see so well on the screen, the Temple Mount is here. Here is Mount Scopus. And here's the village of Anata, and what is called the Green Line flows right here down through the edge of Jerusalem. This Green Line was established as the territory that Yitzhak Rabin negotiated with the Oslo Accords into the hands of Palestinian autonomy. The Palestinians, or some might even say the Philistines, who now would hold such a close margin to Jerusalem, look with ambition upon the holy city itself as their next possession. For now it lies just beyond the green line fence, where someone has painted a rather symbolic replica of the Sistine ceiling on the fence wall. Brethren, again, only a resurrected Jeremiah and Baruch will know just where these documents were secured for many days. It will not surprise us if Jeremiah's land deed will yet be used to annul the claims of foreigners and strangers. Who knows if the early deaths of Rabin and Sharon have suspended the work of giving away the land until the rightful owner appears to lay claim to this God-given inheritance. Furthermore, it will be on the singular testimony of Jeremiah, and not one just claiming to be Jeremiah, for Baruch was also present at the signing and sealing. He may have been one of the co-signers. Now there is no longer archaeological doubt about the existence of real Baruch. He is not part of a biblical myth or conspiracy. When he awakens from the tomb and locates the documents, there'll be no question as to his identity. However, let us look to the record of archaeology. In 1982, excavation continued in the city of David. In a four-room house, a cache of 51 small buttons were discovered. Baked hard by fire, these buttons were in fact ancient clay seals inscribed with the names of their owners. The technical name for these seals is bulle, B-U-L-L-A-E. And so the place that they were found is now called the Bulle House. Seldom does archaeology reveal artifacts bearing the names of people mentioned in the Bible. But among these bulle was found one of Gemariah, the son of Shaphan. He was the very one who advised Jehoiakim not to burn the scroll of Jeremiah. But there was other notable Bible characters found on these seals. Another cache of over 250 inscribed bulle surfaced from the city of David. Found among this collection was a seal bearing the name Baruch, son of Neriah, the scribe. This Baruch was none other than the confident and personal scribe of the prophet Jeremiah himself. He was a strategic part of the drama during the last days of the first temple and was once hidden by the Lord with Jeremiah when King Jehoiakim sought to arrest them. But an even more striking revelation concerning this scribe was yet to come. Recently, it was revealed that another bulle with the same name of Baruch existed in a private collection. The seal, however, has an incredible difference. Preserved in the now hardened clay is the imprint of a finger. Since this bulle belonged to Baruch, he is the one who would have last touched the wet clay when sealing the papyrus scroll that is sealed. Therefore, this is most likely the actual fingerprint of Baruch, son of Neri, the scribe, the secretary to Jeremiah. Who knows what might have been written on the scroll sealed by this bulle? Could it have been the copy of the sealed deed of purchase mentioned in Jeremiah 32, verse 14? Or perhaps a copy of Jeremiah's prophecies that conclude this chapter in verses 37 to 40? Behold, I will gather them out of the countries whither I have driven them in mine anger, And I will bring them again into this place and will cause them to dwell safely. And they shall be my people, and I will be their God. And I will make an everlasting covenant with them. Brethren, truth is stranger than fiction. We now have the notary seal of the scribe. Soon Jeremiah himself may produce the evidence appointed by God that sealed the purchase in the rightful Levitical city of Joshua's division and Abraham's inheritance. This will not be settled in the courts and congresses, accords, or treaties of the world, but it will be in the words of Zechariah 4, verse 6. This is the word of the Lord unto Zerubbabel, saying, "Not by might, nor by power, but by my spirit, saith the Lord of hosts." Brethren, we'd like to conclude this lesson by referring again to the shortest parable that Jesus ever made that we mentioned at the beginning of the lesson in Matthew 13, verse 44. The kingdom of heaven is likened to a treasure hid in a field, the which when a man hath found, he hideth, and for joy thereof goeth and selleth all that he hath, and buyeth that field. You are the treasure. You are the pearl of great price that is even now hidden from the eyes of the world. And Jesus has purchased the whole field, the world, and with it, he has also acquired you, his bride. May the Lord add his blessing.